Hello and welcome to, I think it's episode 4 of The Two Tones. Episode 5. It's
the Juddy. Who's counting?
Exactly. It's the Juddy McKay episode of The Two Tones. Thanks again to Sam Pang for coming in last week. They got a good crowd at their post-match function against Essendon, which sadly saw the Blues going down. But a spirited performance. Tony DeBolfo, you're at the game. I was too. I did go to the game. I took my 8-year-old. I left at three-quarter time.
Sam Pang owes you an apology, Tony, straight off the top.
I won't hold my breath.
But, yes, I did venture back to the Carlton Social Club after the game. Probably around about 500 people in the room. It was fantastic. I saw a lot of people that I hadn't seen since the wild, heady days of the JJ Higgins Bar here at the Carlton Social Club. But it was fabulous. All the players were in attendance. I saw Jim Buckley and David Rhys-Jones amongst the past players. And it was great that everyone at Carlton was united under the one roof. And that's what we have to be going forward, Tone. I'm sure of it.
Well, what were your thoughts? We'll move on to the team selection in a minute. But your thoughts, the game against Essendon. I thought we had a red hot go, but kicking was very bad, obviously.
Look, I think you've nailed it. We had our chances, no doubt about it, and the scores reflect as much. You know, it was Aaron kicking. Really, not only for goal, but field kicking was what really hurt us, and has done for a little while, I suspect. But it was great to see that we're in the game for, you know, the majority of the contest, and you know, a little bit of polish here and there, a bit of poise might have got us across the line, but after the terrible fade-outs of previous weeks, it was just magnificent to see the team really hang in there and show a little bit of spine, which is really, at the end of the day, all you ask.
The game will be notable to Tony DeBolfo's of the future, the future club historians, if you want to put it that way, for the debut of Kieran Burns.
Well, Kieran Byrne, look, I really thought that when the sub was activated and Kieran Byrne came on for Ed Curnow, that Byrne's presence actually ignited the team into action in that final frenetic last quarter.
It was really exciting. I saw him zipping across half back and I thought, this is great, this is good.
And you know, you go to the football as a Carlton fan, you want to see, you know, as you said, the faces of the future. And really, looking at Kieran Byrne, he's got everything that you want to see in a player. He's quick, he attacks the ball, he's got presented. Presence, he presents, he's a good decision maker, and, you know, he's hard at it. What more could you ask for in a player? I just was so thrilled to see him go about his game the way he did. He's a lovely fellow. His parents are lovely people who, as you said, made the effort to be here for that historic game.
It's a long way to come.
And what a shame. Oh. What a downer that, you know, they've probably booked their flights to Wellington. Unfortunately, now knowing that poor old Casey Byrne has done a hammy and won't be part of the flight across.
So what happened? He did a hammy on the training track, did he?
On the training track during the week, early in the week, fairly innocuous thing, I understand. I mean, you know, he would have been so upbeat about his performance at the weekend and thoroughly looking forward to the Wellington game. There you go. That's the peaks and troughs of football, Tony, and the unpredictability of it.
He saw one of the troughs on his debut game into the third quarter. Can I just say, I don't want to go on about it. It was an absolutely boneheaded umpiring decision. As a lot of them happened to be right in front of Essendon's goal, who would have thought they get an easy free kick and a goal because Kieran Byrne had simply shepherded. It was a light shepherd off the ball, and I don't want to sound too twisted and bitter about it, but I just thought, fair play, umpy, it's his first game. I mean, you can let that one go. But what I did see, though, and this is a wonderful gesture from Jammo, who we know is a superstar. Took him aside, you know, just put his arm around him, just explain, look, don't worry, let it go, which is probably advice I should heed. But just, I thought, great leadership from a senior player to a bloke playing his first game. I thought that was just spectacular stuff from Jammo.
That's leadership, isn't it? Yeah. And that's what you want to see, not only from your captain, but from all your players in that team. And as you say, that was a pretty level-headed, measured response from Jammo, particularly when there's, you know, lunatics like you and I, you know, shouting from the belches, you know, the bleachers over the fence. But I thought that was fairly level-headed of Jammo to do that, and at the end of the day, you're not going to change the decision, are you? So you move on.
No, no. That's one thing we should do maybe, so I'll stop frothing about it. But it was a stupid decision. Now, let's preview the team. So we do have a few ins and outs, obviously. We mentioned Kieran Byrne not playing, but however, Tone, the bad news is...
Well, the bad news is, on top of the Chris Yaron suspension, of course, that the great man, C. Judd, is unfortunately out of the game, the legacy of just a niggling back complaint. Look, it's a four-hour flight to New Zealand, and I noted that St Kilda were very mindful of Nick Riewoldt's condition at his age, that probably a trip to NZ may not be necessarily his best interest. So whether that's impacted on the club's thinking or not, I'm not sure, but look, it's a massive loss. I mean, C. Judd has started the year in terrific fashion, and I mean, the Carlton team really needs all its players up and about, so it's going to be a massive loss. But you know what, it provides someone else with the opportunity now, and as we've just said a moment ago with Jammo, it would be nice to see someone take the leadership baton now in Judd's absence.
And who will that be, do you think?
Well,
who's already been named?
Well, look, Mark Murphy, obviously, as captain, will lead them out. But you just want to see, you know, leadership from players across the board. You know, the players that have been around the place for a little bit now are the ones that you want to really see marshal the forces.
And Carrazzo, he can, you know.
Yeah, he's another one. Bryce Gibbs, you know, Walker's back now, and
it was great to see him back.
It was.
Yeah, I thought he definitely made a difference to, he contested. It was just great to see him out there, just playing.
Yes, yeah, absolutely. And he set off after the game that, you know, really this had been an issue. His injury had been an issue he'd laboured with for the best part of 9 months.
Yeah.
So, you know, sometimes you forget what these fellows actually have to endure, not only through the course of the season proper, but in the off-season months where they're trying to do their best to get their body right for the campaign. And unfortunately, for whatever reason, the body just lets them down. And I think with Andrew Walker's case, it was a knee complaint, cyst behind the knee that had given him all sorts of grief. And
did you say cyst?
Yeah,
cyst behind the knee,
which he'd had to put up with, and really couldn't overcome for a long period. So all power to him for doing so well in his comeback match, and let's hope it's smooth sailing for him from here on in.
It was great. So now previewing the game. Of course, Juddy's out, Byrne out. Any others? Is that's the limit of the damage, I hope?
Well, Chris Yaron, of course, with the suspension, has gone for three.
Who should have got, as somebody said today, fellow Carlton supporter, he should have got a Brownlow vote for hitting Chappie. But unfortunately, it doesn't work that way.
Yes, no, it didn't work that way. But look, it was disappointing. You know, I mean, again, we can ill afford to have, you know, players of Chris Yaron's calibre sitting in the stands watching on. So, that said, it will be interesting to see how Blaine Bakehorst, fares in his first game for the Carlton Football Club, much heralded number one draft choice from Western Australia. Great to see him getting a Guernsey, named on interchange alongside Dylan Buckley.
Great.
Is also back.
Friend of the podcast.
Yes, and Tut has also been named on the interchange for the Carlton team. So, again, as I say, Tone, you know, we I suppose talked in glowing terms of Casey Byrne last week, and you know, to see Bokhorst there was something that I think all Carlton supporters will look forward to doing. And Dylan Buckley's another one that I think just gives us that energy that for which all supporters are craving. So let's see how it all pans out. There's a real element of the unknown in those players and what they're capable of producing and how far they'll go. But let's, you know, just take it all in and tune in from 11 a.m.
Well, yes, I want to get to that in a sec. But, you know, there was media about Mick saying he wasn't going to play the kids, that they'd earn their spot, it was all going to be done on merit. To a certain extent, Tone, injury has forced his hand, which is a good thing. So we do get to see the likes of Bokhorst running around. What, is it sooner than we thought?
Look, he had a pretty good game, I understand, playing for Northern Blues last weekend. I didn't see it, but certainly the players that have been called up have been included on form.
Right.
And Coach Malthouse is on the record to say that, you know, there won't be, you know, spots.
A policy just, of just playing the kids for the sake of it.
Exactly right. You know, so form dictates their selection, and that's a good thing. And the players that are there have earned their spots, and, you know, let's hope they can carry their good form through.
Malthouse and records are to be discussed in a second tone, but it is a big game, obviously, in New Zealand. As you said, 10:30. In all your days of following football, is this the early? You'd need virtually need to set an alarm to get out of bed to catch this game. Is it the earliest game of football you think you've ever witnessed?
Well, look, I was thinking this through before. All I can compare it with, Tony, and we're talking senior footy. We're not talking the reserve grade.
8:15 at Parkside Oval, watching my kid running around.
That's it. We're looking
at 8 in the morning.
I can't think of a senior game that's started, you know, that early, with the probable exception of the off-season internationals that have been back at about 1 or 2 a.m. But, I mean, 10:30, 11 o'clock, it's footy over your bacon and eggs, isn't it?
It's brunch football is what it is.
It's
11:10, I think, is the time they'll ball the... Yeah. The ball goes up.
The pies would be pretty cold at quarter past 10, would they?
Well, especially in a place like Wellington, it is chilly.
Have you been there, Tony?
I have, yes.
What can you, for the listeners that are acquainted, I'm one of them.
Yeah.
Wellington.
It's a beautiful city. It's not big. There's no city in New Zealand. You know, the largest city is about the size of Adelaide. That's Auckland. But Wellington, I believe, was designed by Colonel William Bright.
Not Bly.
I'm going to get in a lot of trouble for this because he's the architect behind Adelaide. And I lived in Adelaide for two and a half years.
Colonel Light.
Thank you. Should have known that. And apologies to SA listeners. So it's designed, it has a layout very similar to Adelaide's. It's a planned city. There are gardens in the centre and it is an absolutely beautiful city. It's a very hard place to land a plane.
Is that so?
The winds come in and they kind of, there's this dress circle, if you like there is in Adelaide, and the wind whips up over the bay and New Zealand, Air New Zealand have had to order planes that have been, I guess, almost tailored for the Wellington approach because it is so windy.
Is that so?
So the boys, there are a few white knuckles on touchdown, I would imagine.
Yeah, it's good local knowledge that you provide, Tony, and let's hope the wind blows straight down the middle of Wellington Stadium and Mark Murphy wins the toss. One little disconcerting line I'd like to throw into the mix, Tony, is that Vive Capston, who is an employee here at the club, works in the finance department, is a New Zealander and has kept an eye on the radar.
Uh-oh.
And reliably informs me there's been two earthquakes in the last 24 hours or so, measuring 4 or 5 thereabouts on the Richter scale. So let's hope nothing too serious comes of that. But I can tell you this, I don't recall seeing a game of senior league football prior to 12 noon in the afternoon, but I definitely can say that I've never seen a game stopped due to an earthquake.
Any other kind of natural disaster?
Hail's probably, or lightning's probably as bad as it gets here, isn't it?
Yeah, well, there's been a bit of flooding in the past, but that's mainly with Pagan when he was coaching the Roos. Whee! Look, the other thing about it too is that it's one of, I think, about 5 AFL games, isn't it, over the course of Anzac Day. I remember is it a bit of overkill?
Gee whiz, it might be, but I can remember Carlton and Essendon playing Anzac Day games before big crowds at VFL Park. I can remember being one of about 75,000 going to an Anzac Day against Essendon, I'm sure, at Waverley. When that was a standalone game. Well, I'm thinking mid to late 70s.
Wow.
And that was a sort of a standalone game at the time. So if you're thinking about it in that context, and you look at how far it's come, look, maybe it is a little bit overblown, but in saying that, it's the 100th anniversary, so I suppose this is a year where, you know, Anzac Day comes into even greater focus. So, I think it's a good thing that people and clubs and organisations are acknowledging the story.
Yeah.
Not only of Anzac, but of the conflicts that happen in all, you know, involving people in all wars.
Well, just on that tone, there was a very special event here at Icon Park. Did I get that right? Yes, good, thank you. Icon Park, Princes Park, to the old school amongst us, and you see it as you come in. It's quite an arresting thing as you come into the administration offices here. To the left hand side, there is a plaque, and it bears the names of all those who have played for Carlton and gone on to lose their lives in the services of their country throughout two world wars, especially this First World War and the Second World War that are mentioned there. And Tone, you would be across a lot of those stories, I would imagine.
Yes, Tone. I was here on Wednesday morning when the ceremony took place. It probably only took 10, 15 minutes, but it involved all the players, all the staff being on hand for the unveiling of the memorial. The President, Mark Legutige, laid a wreath at the memorial. Mark Murphy accepted a lone pint from one of the army officers that had come to the club from Simpson Barracks. And the descendants of two of our players lost in wartime were given the honour of unveiling the memorial, carrying the names of the 11 Carlton players killed in the First World War and the 5 players killed in the Second World War. So just to give you a little example, Joan Shinner, who was the daughter of the late Jim Park. Jim Park was a premiership player for Carlton in 1938, who was unfortunately killed in New Guinea fighting the Japanese in 1943.
Flying Boston bombers. They're an excellent plane that the only Air VC that we won in World War II was won by, it would have been it depends if he was in 22 Squadron, I think, but was won by a pilot of a Boston bomber.
Is that so?
So, yeah, they were, and this was right in the savage fighting in 1943 going on. So
yes.
He was right in the thick of it.
Right in the thick of it. And unfortunately, Joan was only really a toddler of 3 years of age when her father was killed. And I spoke to Joan at the service and asked her if, do you have any memory of Jim Park? And she said, no, unfortunately, I don't have any memory at all of my father. But she was really thrilled, honoured to be there to unveil the memorial to her dad and the other men who died. The other person given the honour of unveiling the memorial was a fellow named Chad Nash, whose great uncle, Finn McDonald, was killed on the day of the Gallipoli landing 100 years ago this Saturday. And Chad and his mother will be in Wellington on that day to see Carlton hopefully beat St Kilda.
Yes.
Wow. So it was a great thing for the club to honour all those men who had died. And as you say, Tony, it's a striking memorial that is front and centre at the doors of the Carlton Football Club, and will hopefully serve as a permanent reminder to the men who have died and the futility of war.
Well, there's that, and also our duty as citizens to protect democracy and our values from harm and those who wish to threaten us. So it's an enduring reminder of, as you say, Tone, the debt we owe to those who have paid.
Yeah, so, you know, and you're thinking about it, Tone, there's one little story I'd like to share that relates to the social club, going back to the social club after the Essendon game on Saturday night. I happened to bump into Tom Bell's father, who had come back for a drink, and we got talking about the Anzacs and the week ahead, and Mr. Bell had mentioned to me, he said, my own father served in Tobruk.
Oh, wow.
And I said to him, did he make it back? And he said, he did indeed. And he said, lived to quite an old age. And he said, I remember not long before he died, he said to me, son, I know I'm going to heaven because I've already been to hell.
Yes. It's not a good war, as they say. That was I think Peter Fitzsimons, no, I'm getting it wrong. Somebody has written the definitive book about Australians in Tobruk, and he can be very proud of having served in a pivotal battle in World War II. Oops. Where Germany, I guess it lends itself to football analogies, I guess, unfortunately, Tone, but Germany's run was checked by staunch defence, led by and including Australians, Commonwealth forces, but Australians were right up there, and Tobruk was a key battle. Mm. And, we've turned the tide of that war in North Africa, and it was after one of those, I think it was Al Alamein, Tobruk said, Churchill said, before Al Alamein, we never had a victory. After it, we never had a defeat.
Is that so?
So, yeah, It's all North Africa. And Tobruk, it was a desert port that the Germans were absolutely desperate to get. They needed it for supplies that were coming across the Mediterranean, and the Commonwealth forces' defence was just too tenacious. So, yes, Tommy Bell should be particularly proud of his grandfather for the role he played. Now, it's a great record coming up. You mentioned it's almost like a squaring of the circle or a kind of a record's coming home, if you like, Tone.
Look, Tone, you're absolutely right. We've been sort of obviously very mindful, like everyone has, about the upcoming record of 714 games of Jock McCarles as coach that our coach Mick Malthouse is about to equal in Wellington this week. And look, one incredible stat in relation to the number 714, 714 also happens to be the record number of home runs that Babe Ruth hit in American baseball, that a record that stood for 39 years until Hank Aaron hit the 715th home run in 74. So that, as I said, that record stood the best part of four decades. McHale's record of 714 games, everyone says that it stood for 60 years or more since McHale's passing, but we were in the office today and the question was put, well, everyone knows that Mick Malthouse is about to break Jock McHale's record, but which coach's record did Jock McHale break? And so we went back to the record books, and lo and behold, Jock McHale broke the 279-game coaching record set by Jack Worrell.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Carlton's premiership coach, who I'm afraid to admit, later coached Essendon to two premierships also. But
we'll strike that from the record.
But isn't it lovely that, you know, for Collingwood supporters lamenting the fact that their jock is about to lose their record, well, we can say, well, we're only regaining what's rightfully ours. Thank because you. It was Jock that took the record from Jack Worrell in the first place.
It's coming home where it belongs.
That's football karma, I think.
Yes. Now, so, speaking of 1915, believe it's a centenary of a Carlton premiership, is it? Or is it not?
It is. It was the first of, I think, five premiership victories over Collingwood. Five from five, Tone,
yes.
So they say.
Yes.
So anyone that was around in 1910 would have seen Collingwood beat Carlton for the first and last time in a grand final. And I don't know that there's anyone still about the place that might have been there in 1910, Tone. I certainly haven't met anyone that can lay claim to of being there the day.
That won't stop Collingwood supporters from still whinging about it and probably the bad umpiring.
Very true. Very true.
I can talk. But, we'd like to see a centenary celebration of that too while you're at it.
That would be lovely. That would be lovely.
Now, I think that's about it for us today, Tone.
Yes, the only thing I'd like to throw into the mix, Tone, if I can get that out, is that we have a list prepared by Julian of the Carlton players that have also run around for St Kilda.
Reading this before the podcast started, I was really surprised at the number of players that have played, not only the number, but also the prominence of some of these names.
Yes, a lot of them were pensioned off to St Kilda, of course, Tone. Yes. We've got the best out of them. And I can just throw one name into the mix, Alex Marcoux. Alex Marcoux, you know, had this sensational career at Carlton.
I loved Alex Marcoux as a kid. Awesome player.
A brilliant player, yeah. And was part of that famed mosquito fleet, yeah, that saved the successes of the late 70s, early 80s.
Beautiful.
Absolutely
just,
beautiful. He went to St Kilda, walked in at Moorabbin and looked around and said, "What the hell have I done?" And he realised then and there that this was a bad, bad career.
He wouldn't have been the first. Rod Gault is on that list.
Spook Gault. Spook Gault was at St Kilda first and then came to Carlton.
Right. Was he originally from South Australia, if I remember right?
That's a good question.
I remember Rod Gault taking a mark as a kid where it looked like he... He was virtually upside down.
Yes.
And it looked like he'd broken his neck.
Really?
That's one of my first memories.
Well, the number 17, I think of Brent Croswell if memory serves.
So, yeah, that was, God, when would I have seen that? That would have been about 1977, I think.
77,
that
yeah, that's so, true. Yeah, but, and there's been, look, you look down the list, I mean, Alex Jesolenko.
Peter McConville
went across. I think that was manager issue. There was a loggerheads with the club and the player manager over that one, and that was a shame because McConville was, you know, a great player in his own right.
Yes, he was. Yes.
And then you look at, you know, Warren Jones, Val Perovic. Now Val Perovic,
yes.
He went from them to us, and that was over a row he had with Lindsay Fox.
Oh yeah.
Where Lindsay Fox put the acid on Val to relocate from Ballarat to train closer to Moorabbin.
Yeah.
And Val, in no uncertain terms, basically told Lindsay to get stuffed. And he stayed put in Ballarat. And Keith McKenzie, the then secretary of the club, was a recruiter here, I'm pretty sure, chartered a helicopter to get up to Ballarat,
yeah,
and get Val's signature. And the rest of the course, as they say, is history. Val was a two-time premiership player for Carlton in those, you know, those back-to-back sides of 81, 82.
Yes, inking a contract for a man not shy of ink at all.
No,
by his,
no,
forearms,
no.
And all the rest of him. How about Ken Sheldon and Alex Jesolenko, two players you never would have heard of, two obscure kind of players in the Carlton Football Club history?
Yes, well, you know, those two players, of course, were, well, Sheldon, you mentioned, actually ended up coaching St Kilda, as we know, with reasonable success.
Yes, he got them to a final, didn't he?
That's true, that's true. There's a name not here, Tone, Edward Clark. I don't find his name, but I'm pretty sure that Edward Clark was a best and fairest winner here at Carlton in the 30s,
yeah,
who decided to go to St Kilda on the eve of the 38th season, if memory serves, to captain and coach.
Yeah.
And unfortunately for him, Carlton took out the 38 grand final. Oh. And he'd been a very good player for the Carlton Football Club. So I did get to meet Edward Clark over the years, and until he died, he lamented that decision. You know,
did he leave mid-season, Tone?
No, I think it was at the end of 37.
Right, okay.
You know, he'd given good service to the club right through the 30s. Yeah. So that's the cruel side of football, I think, Tone.
No shortage of those.
Dean
How about
Rice?
This? Dean Rice, who I think has been mentioned in every episode of The Two Tones because he's a personal favourite of mine.
Yes.
And good to see him there mentioned. We skipped past Wow Jones.
Well, Wow Jones.
What were you thinking?
What was I thinking?
A spherical Camillus.
The two of the great, you know, the great names of the Carlton Football Club, and great characters, and still are around the place. You often see Wow back at the Spirit of Carlton functions. Spiro, I think, still runs the bike shop in Sydney Road, just up the way here in Brunswick. And, you know, both of them love the club and are forever coming back whenever there's an occasion to be celebrated. So,
yeah,
two great Carlton men.
Sean Charles, who we talked about earlier.
Sean Charles, a prodigiously gifted player from Melbourne, played his best footy there. Terribly unlucky in the sense that I reckon he played one and one only game here at Carlton and badly broke his leg, which effectively put paid to his career. And I can remember in my other life as a reporter being sent up the highway to Kerrang to track him down after he'd actually left the club. And thinking back on it now, I think he just needed to get get away from the game and from Melbourne and to basically, you know, get through a pretty difficult period for him, you know, with the injury and whatever.
I have to ask, post-football, had he gone all Michael Long, Derek Kickett on us? Had he found a good paddock, Tone?
Do you know, I don't honestly know, Tony. I would love to know what has happened to Sean Charles, where he is today, because I haven't seen him really since that time that he left Carlton.
He could play.
Oh, he could play, all right. He was a nice player.
Now, how about these names? Sam Cranage, we do remember. Aaron Hamill and Matty Lappin.
Well, Aaron Hamill, you know, Aaron Hamill was the man that John Elliott got off the hook for the grand final in 99,
yep,
from memory.
Yep. I always remember, I mean, he was wearing the number 4. He was given the number 4 jumper, and John Elliott actually mentioned that, I think, at some point bitterly when he decided to cross town. There was the talk of, if you want to go to St Kilda, I'll give you the cab fare, that sort of stuff.
Yes, and Hamill, you know, crossed to Moorabbin at a time where players just didn't leave Carlton. Mm. In fact, players came to Carlton. Yeah. So this really hurt because it went against the entire grain. Had a great career for St Kilda, but it was a great loss to us.
Yeah, really.
On the flip side, Matty Lappin, who you mentioned,
skinny,
one of the great players for the Carlton Football
just
Club. And
awesome.
You know, I always looked at Matt Lappin and always used to say, think to myself, what are you doing out there?
Yeah.
You know, with the physique and the frame you have, it defied logic that he could actually survive a quarter.
Absolutely fearless.
He was a terribly gifted player and a great Carlton servant over many years.
Kane Ackland was the result of, I think, more tirades from me than possibly any Carlton player in the last 10 years.
Yes.
Mick kind of put him down at one press conference, didn't he? There was some kind
was
of
it
subtle,
Kane Ackland, was it?
I'm pretty sure it was Kane Ackland.
Okay, So,
he said something uncomplimentary about him, I think.
A frustrating footballer tone, perhaps you'd say.
We didn't mention Mark Arcieri.
Mark Arcieri, you know, played some good games for North Melbourne also, and I think famously kicked our first goal in time on in the wet at the Witten Oval one day. I think our first goal for the game came late in the last quarter of that windswept, moth-eaten place out at Footscray, and Mark Arcieri kicked it. We didn't have too many happy experiences out at Footscray in those days, but Mark, I remember, did kick that lone goal.
You have reminded me of, and I'm sure I've mentioned this on the podcast before, the 95 game against St Kilda at Waverley. It was a freezing cold day. I remember that. And it was howling a gale. It was pissing down. And didn't kick a goal until the 18-minute mark of the third quarter or thereabouts. And lost the game against. You know, that we'd lost the week before
to Sydney
on a Friday night. Yeah.
Yes, and that was also the game, I'm sure, that Rod Keogh knocked out Mil Hanna.
Oh, really?
On the wing. And I remember sitting there and walking out of the place and thinking, we're in all sorts of trouble.
Yeah.
And it's history now that we won the next 60 on the trot, including the grand final. So how good a judge am I?
Well, it was a low ebb, and you had every reason to be worried because that was not a pretty game of football from memory.
It wasn't.
As you say, turned it around and won it in grand style.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
All right, Tone, that is the end of our podcast.
Lovely to see you again,
Tone. You too. I love it. We'll be back next week.
With a win.
You're damn right. Yes. Go Blues. As we always say here, go Blues. The Two Tones, back next week. Thanks for your company.